Hello.
Hello there.
How are you?
I am good. How are you?
Pretty good.
Good,
Pretty
good.
good.
Good, good. Let
Yep.
me. Whenever these recordings go on, there's like 15,000 little pop-up screens, and it's kind of like, I know you're recording. I don't need to see 15,000 pop-up screens to know that. Just a little timer is good. Great. Well, thank you for being on. Actually, this is like the day of doing pre-records. I had Gary himself on about 7 hours ago.
All right.
So this is a pre-record for I think the 15th of May. Let me just double check that one. May 15th, indeed. It won't be later. It might be the week before, but it won't be later, because we are doing a series of pre-records because we're going to travel. Right, Georgia Guidestones. Is there anything else you want me to tackle? Is there something you want to promote? Is there something you want to say?
Nothing in particular besides the book that I want to promote. I mean, I guess, and if you ask me about like my past before writing the book, I'll probably talk a little bit about some of the podcasts that I've made
Okay.
over the years. And those have typically been both radio and internet broadcasts, typically on sort of weird fringe topics like the occult or conspiracy theories or counterculture or these sorts of things.
Okay.
So, I mean, if we can go down any of those roads
Okay.
if you feel like that during the interview, that's fine. I mean, I oh, that sounds a lot better. I don't know what just happened, but all right. Anyway, yeah, I'm ready when you are. And have you got the book? Have you been able to read it? Or was this sort of a quick kind of.
I did not get the book, so this is I will not even pretend I know the book. I'm just going to interview you about basically, the Georgia Guidestones, and then you can take it from there.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind as we're going through. That doesn't bother. Some authors are real uppity about that. That doesn't bother me at all. I'm just happy to be able to do an interview. So, whatever,
Do you work for this information?
I used to for many
Okay.
years. I was there the promotions director for the company for 2 years, and for about 3.5 years, we produced a podcast for them, which I
Okay.
guess we did about 30 episodes with
Okay.
them. And now they've got a new host. I've gone on and gone back to grad school and released this book, which they were nice enough to publish, which is great. And I'm moving on to other projects after this. So we had, yeah, it was pretty good tenure there. I got to say it was fun. So.
Cool. Do you want to say anything about the upcoming projects, or is that something for a future moment in time?
I'll hint at it a little bit at the very end, but
Okie dokie.
I'm not ready to make any announcements. Our project is currently titled Untitled, so
It's a great title.
it is so many people end up using it for so long till they have to make a decision. So
I have various software programs who always mention that that might be a good title for whatever I'm doing as well.
exactly. So am I
Okay.
coming in okay?
Oh, absolutely. This is 1 hour, just under. There's an intro, music intro at the beginning and end, which you will not hear because it gets edited in later. It's recorded as live, but if something goes wrong, then we can always pick it up. So we don't like to edit, but if we have to edit, that's absolutely no problem. So if you're ready.
I'm ready.
Okay. Welcome to another edition of the Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens, and unfortunately, Kathleen can't be with us today. Today, we are, however, going to go and explore one of those really mysterious things which modern America has got to offer. And you may have seen it on documentaries, either a complete documentary or just a mention of these amazing stones. Oh, I'm giving it away there, aren't I? Because the subject of today really is the Georgia Guidestones. And we have, I think, the expert on these stones with us today, Raymond Wiley. Raymond, welcome.
Philip, it's great to be on the show today.
Well, thanks for coming on our show. First of all, can you, for those people who have somehow missed it, can you explain what the Georgia Guidestones are and why they are mysterious?
Sure. Well, the Georgia Guidestones are a massive granite monument that sit on a hilltop in the quiet rural town of Elberton, Georgia. It's in the east northeastern part of Georgia, far away from Atlanta or other civilized locales, not too far from the Savannah River. And there on a hillside, you'll find this monument. It looks a little bit like Stonehenge. It's obviously much newer. It was built in 1979. But there's a lot of controversy and mystery surrounding this giant structure. It's 19 feet tall. It's about 950 cubic feet of granite, and it weighs about 250,000 pounds. So anyway, it's not just the strangeness of its design and the way that it harkens back to ancient megaliths like Stonehenge that make it controversial and make it a site of interest in to the people here in Georgia or to the people in the United States at large. It's this controversy that tends to bring people. There are, unlike Stonehenge, there's something written on the Georgia Guidestones. There's a message, 10 guidelines to guide the future of humanity, ostensibly after some terrible catastrophe has happened. These 10 guidelines are etched into the stones in the same messages are etched in 8 of the most common modern languages. So each face of the stones has this message, these 10 precepts or guidelines written on it, and each is a different language. And then there's a capstone surmounting the top of the monument, and it also has multiple languages. Across the capstone, the message is written, "Let these be guidestones to an age of reason." And this is spelled out in Egyptian hieroglyphics and ancient Phoenician and ancient Babylonian, as well as I think one other ancient language across the top. So they appear at once as a Rosetta Stone, a thing that could be used to translate languages if you didn't have access to the internet or the kinds of books that you'd find in your normal library anymore. But they also carry this message. So, and you know, I figure before we get much further into it, it's probably best for me to talk about some of these 10 guidelines.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. I'm just going to read them. I'm just going to try to go through this fairly quickly for those of you, because I know some of you have probably heard of the guidestones before. I'm just going to quickly read through the 10 guidelines that are etched into it. Maintain humanity under 500 million in perpetual balance with nature. Guide reproduction wisely, improving fitness and diversity. Unite humanity with a new living language. Rule passion, faith, tradition, and all things with tempered reason. Protect people and nations with fair laws and just courts. Let all nations rule internally, resolving external disputes in a world court. Avoid petty laws and useless officials. Balance personal rights with social duties. Prize truth, beauty, love, seeking harmony with the infinite. And the final one, be not a cancer on the earth. Leave room for nature. Leave room for nature.
So the stones are clearly having a political message as well. They are, unlike I would say the Ten Commandments, they are, you know, very much almost, I mean, okay, the guide stones, but these are almost like instruction stones.
Very much so. And they're, if you look at the way the language is used, and it's very vague, obviously, and I think it was purposefully meant to be vague, a lot of this stuff. But if you look at it, especially this first one, maintain humanity under 500 million in perpetual balance with nature. Now, we'll talk in a moment about the controversy over that number, what different people think that means, and how it tends to make some people think that the Guidestones are very sinister. But before we get into that, let's just look at this first word, maintain humanity under 500 million. Who are the Guidestones meant to be read by? Who is this monument for? This word maintain seems to indicate, also being the very first word in the monument, seems to indicate that this is meant for people in the future. This isn't necessarily meant for the tourists who are seeing it on its Georgia hillside each week. That makes you start wondering, what's going on? What is the point? What is being inferred by all of this? You know.
Well, I mean, okay, let's ask a very simple question, and then, of course, the mystery of the Guidestones kind of like becomes more apparent, I guess. Who built it?
Ah, yes. See, this is the other part of the mystery. Not only do we have these 10 strange guidelines, we have this man of mystery, R.C. Christian, who is the alleged creator of the Georgia Guidestones, the one who came up with its design and paid for the monument to be built. Now, R.C. Christian is admittedly a pseudonym. So this guy was not giving, according to the tale, this guy was not giving his real name. And this is the tale we tell in the very first chapter of the book, where the mysterious stranger comes to town one day, shows up at one of the best granite finishing companies in the area, and says, "Oh, I want to build this massive granite monument." And he's initially dismissed, right? The guy that runs the company, Joe Finley, thinks it's a prank put on by some of his Shriner buddies. And so he sends the guy away initially and sends him to the banker in town, Wyatt Martin, who we have excerpts from an interview with in the book and whose story we tell as well. Martin meets this guy, R.C. Christian, and within just a very few minutes, this is back in 1979, realizes that the guy's on the level and that he actually does want to build this giant granite monument and he has the money to do it. But he realized, the banker realized, or R.C. Christian said to him, "Surely you realize that R.C. Christian is not my real name. I don't want anybody to know who I actually am." And the banker said, "Well, you know, I'll have to have your personal information to be able to build this monument, to be able to underwrite this." And so they struck a deal. This is back in 1979, that he would use this Wyatt Martin's bank to underwrite this project to get the Guidestones built, and that Wyatt Martin would never reveal the identity of R.C. Christian. And to this point, up until this day, he never has, and says he's going to take the secret to his grave with him. So we have one man in the town who knows who he actually was, who isn't talking. We have a few other people in the town that were able to meet him in the very few times that he ever came to Elberton, and we interview a few of them. And so we get some anecdotal stories, some description of what he looks like, and some of his backstory, but we don't know exactly what his true identity is. So, and that has also caused a lot of speculation.
Have you got any indications as to what his, or also kind of like derivations of, like, you know, what he has written on those Guidestones? The choice of language would suggest a certain man of a certain background. Have you been able to draw those conclusions, or found out information which would support conclusions to be drawn?
Yes. Luckily, R.C. Christian left behind a book that he had written as well. This book is called Common Sense Renewed. You can get it at the Elbert Granite Museum. You can write them for a copy if you're in Europe or far away from Georgia. You won't be able to find it on Amazon or anything like that, at least not right now. So he wrote this book, Common Sense Renewed, just telling why he built the Guidestones, never revealing his true identity, and only giving very few facts about his backstory. But in it, he describes in detail why he built the monument, what his purpose behind it was, what he meant with each of the 10 guidelines, and we get an interesting picture of a man with interesting, sometimes very forward-thinking political beliefs and some other political beliefs that are crazy and really harsh. and we sort of we get this dual picture of this man when we read his book. So
what kind of are the crazy ideas which he is proposing? Or
okay, let's go over some of this stuff because you know, later in the interview, I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about conspiracy theories and certain theories that people have about a new world order, the Illuminati, and these sorts of things, and how they may have built the Georgia Guidestones. So, you know, the main tenet of those conspiracy theories seems to be the idea that the builder of this monument, R.C. Christian, wished that the population would be culled back to 500 million, that he was, in fact, promoting genocide, and that's the true meaning of the Guidestones. You know, this I can understand if you had read this for the first time, you were at the Guidestones, you had no context, you're already a little distrustful of the government anyway. I can see how you would make that inference. But R.C. Christian in his book sort of enunciates more clearly what he means by 500 million. And what we find is not a call for genocide, but we find something that is still pretty dark, which is, you know, he suggests that we should have a one-child policy throughout the world, and that a few generations of couples only having one child in their lives would solve our population problem. Now, you know, this kind of stuff's already going on in China, right? So certainly not all the people of the world would necessarily find that to be so very morally repugnant, but, you know, a lot of people here in the West would. So, I mean, that was one thing we know that I noticed. Well, I was like, okay, well, you know, R.C. Christian is really not, doesn't really seem to be, from reading this book, the James Bond villain that many of the conspiracy researchers make him out to be. But he does seem a little harsh. He also suggests, he's talking about unemployment. And he suggests that if one area of the country has really high unemployment, that the government should have the right to compel people to move out of the area and move to another area of the country that had a need for workers. And I mean, that kind of stuff is pretty out there, you know.
And it's also kind of like, you know, I mean, those kind of suggestions are also quite impractical in the sense of like just the one-child policy. The Chinese issue with that comes with tremendous problems of abandoning children, of you know, pretty much abortion rates going up because of gender issues to do with the one child. Obviously, unemployment, moving families because there is unemployment is maybe not the most straightforward thing, rather than getting industry relocated rather than the families, and all of these things are suggesting to me that this man clearly had some amount of money and some kind of vision, but he's not the kind of what I would say a man of the world, a man who has an absolute deep conviction, has been, you know, been to some university or has a background as a major figure. This sounds to me like a man who has ideas, but not necessarily all the expertise to go with it.
Yeah, and I'll take you one step further. Let's say that maybe he is a college professor or something like that, but he's probably not in a humanities field. You know what I'm saying? Like, because he's reaching for high philosophy with what he's writing on the Guidestones, and not necessarily, you know, hitting a home run every time. We'll just put it to you that way. And so I think you're right. I think what we see from the scant details we have about him is a man who had a background in science and business, and maybe government. You know, just based on him talking about that he had traveled a lot, things he had seen in foreign countries, and I think he had probably been reading a lot of ecological and anthropological studies that had come out in the 70s, because remember, this is built in 1979. And if you go back to the kinds of rhetoric, well, I don't want to call it rhetoric, but the kind of language that anthropologists and ecologists were using in the 1970s, like they thought that by now that we would have completely overpopulated the earth and like things would be way worse. I mean, I'm not saying things aren't kind of bad, but like they were making assumptions that things would be way worse than they are, and that the carrying capacity of the earth was perhaps less than it actually is, you know, so on and so forth. I'm not making any arguments against like environmental protection or government regulation of business when I say this. Like, I that's not what I mean when I say this. But I kind of get the idea that he had been reading a lot of that, and it had kind of put the spook on him a little bit. And then we have this the other side of the coin, which is the Cold War. And that's the big central, I think, central issue that's dealt with this, with the Georgia Guidestones and their content, is why does a guy need to leave giant stone tablets with instructions for what to do after the population has somehow been wiped out down below 500 million? Mm-hmm. Because, you know.
Do we have any idea why he wanted that building there?
Oh yes. Now this one is really was really pretty easy. Elberton is the granite capital of the world. Okay, and more granite monuments are quarried and built there than probably any other town on Earth. And there's probably two or three dozen quarries and as many granite finishing companies in the area. It's a big industry there. Stone cutters. You know, he wants the monument to be made of granite because granite is extra hard. In fact, according to Randall Carlson, who's a builder and sort of esoteric expert that we interviewed for the book, he says that, you know, the life of those granite stones is like hundreds of thousands of years or more. That, like, they will, if they are buried in the ground and there is no, like, earthquake or geological upheaval or a comet doesn't hit them or something like that, they're basically going to stay exactly like they are for hundreds of thousands of years. So if you want something that lasts that long, if you want that thick granite, Elberton is the place to go. And that's why he builds them there. And then also, I mean, he could have had them built there and transported somewhere else. But I think the people in the town were really adamant that they wanted to keep this big showcase of their craftsmanship in their town and in their county. And also, I'm sure the cost of transporting these stones, I mean, like I said, they must weigh 50 or 60,000 pounds apiece. I mean, just the cost of transporting them over a long distance would have been hazardous and costly. So, I mean, there is that. So that's why they're there in Elberton, it would seem like. Now, some people believe that R.C. Christian never even existed and that it was all just this big tourist stunt or publicity stunt by the local stonecutters to get people to come and visit their town. And, you know, I mean, I wouldn't put it past a sly businessman to do that, but where did these strange guidelines come from? And why would you go to the lengths to write a, you know, 150-page book explaining it all years after? Like, you know, it didn't – it's really strange, I guess, because, I mean, for the first 20 or so years that they were there in Elberton, very few people knew about them, you know.
Now, one clue might come from an obvious question, which is they sit on a plot of land. Who owns the land, and as such, can we find a connection to the man who built it? Because you would think that just putting something haphazardly on somebody's land might get a reaction from the landowner, and you would then also think that for a person who is building such a monument, which, as you're pointing out, can withstand the test of time, might have been designed to withstand maybe even a nuclear Armageddon, that is a definite preoccupation of this man's mind.
You know, definitely. And I think I don't know, I think there's a lot of places that you can kind of go with it, and there were a lot of different roads we went down, you know, with the research into this man and who he was, why he wanted to build this thing. But, you know, as I was saying a few minutes ago, I want to come back around to this idea of the Cold War, because of all the things in that book that R.C. Christian talks about over and over again, he keeps talking about the relationship between the United States and NATO and the Soviet Union. And, you know, he says basically, and I always quote this, you know, we have turned the world into an atomic tinderbox. And I think that's why granite, and that's, you know, why it has to be etched in stone and why it has to be far away from a major city, you know, in some weird rural place. I think that's a big part of it. Because I think his assumption was, I mean, you got to give, I mean, if you look at the time period, this is 1979, 1980, like the Cold War is really as hot as it had been since the Cuban Missile Crisis, right during that point in time, with all the rhetoric around Reagan's election, and then the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan came not too long after that. Like, things were pretty aggressive. And I think he was, you know, seeing some nuclear scenario happening, and this monument is sort of for the post-nuclear survivors in that Mad Max world, you know?
Is there any connection to the fact that Jimmy Carter was president at that time, and if I'm not mistaken, from around that general region?
Jimmy Carter is from Georgia, though a great distance from that part of Georgia. Georgia's a very big state, so America's is probably at least 200 miles away from where the Georgia Guidestones are. I don't think so. I've never seen any connection to Jimmy Carter. He wasn't at the unveiling or anything like that. I mean, he was the sitting president at the time, so I don't know that he knew quite what was going on in Elberton at the time. So, but there's another figure that often comes up. I'm sorry to interrupt you there. There's another figure from that period in that part of the United States that often comes up, and that's Ted Turner. And there have been a lot of theories that perhaps R.C. Christian was Ted Turner.
And do you buy those theories, or how do you weigh them?
I've seen no evidence, not even circumstantial evidence. I've seen more circumstantial evidence to link R.C. Christian to secret societies from the 17th and 18th centuries than I've got to link it to Ted Turner. And I'll tell you one thing that kind of disqualifies him is that the project looked like, I mean, in our estimation, was only about $200,000 to $300,000 project at the time, even though it's very massive. And they ran out of money in the building process. There was supposed to be another ring of stones around it and a few more astronomical alignments than there currently are, which we can talk about as well if you want. But so I just, like, given Ted Turner's immense wealth, you know, I would think that the project would have been done completely, you know. And that's sort of another thing that points you towards this guy R.C. Christian being like this, some kind of like retired businessman or something that like wanted just to leave something to the world, and that was basically the money that he had saved for his retirement project or whatever. That's what I think. I mean, this may or may not be true. The whole thing could be a cover story. I mean, I have no proof, absolute proof.
Well, whatever he tried to do, it was clear that anonymity was central. 33 years later, we have no identification of him. Nobody stepped forward, as you're saying. The people who knew him are keeping their mouths shut. Are there indications that at some point the identity might be unveiled? And do you have a main suspect? And if so, do you point him out?
Oh, right. Well, I don't reckon that it will ever be unveiled. One of my friends has recently made a film about the Guidestones, which I think is going to be at like Sundance this year, I think. In it, he interviews Wyatt Martin, the banker we were talking about earlier, the man who knows the true identity of R.C. Christian. And in that film, he talks quite a bit, and we use some excerpts from it in the book. But at the very end of the film, they go out and burn all the records and dump them in Lake Oconee. So there's that. So we're not going to find out from Wyatt Martin. Wyatt Martin did say that he received a call a few years ago from R.C. Christian's son. And R.C. Christian's son called him to inform him that R.C. Christian had passed away. And basically they had a minute or two phone conversation. He was like, you know, please, you know, keep your promise to my father and never reveal his true identity. And but this is interesting because Wyatt Martin did say that R.C. Christian's son was in some way famous and that you would know exactly who he was if just from saying his name, and that he was far more famous and notable than R.C. Christian was. So that was an interesting clue. So we have that clue, and then we have little bits of information like he had a Midwestern accent. He used the Latin names for plants when he referred to them. He published his book from a tiny publishing company in Iowa. He said he was a fighter, or said he was a pilot in the Second World War. Like, I mean, if I had like 1,000 chimpanzees on 1,000 computers, and I just set them on that data for about 1,000,000 hours, maybe we'd figure out who R.C. Christian is. But I can totally understand why he would want it to be kept a secret, because that's the whole artistic trick of this thing, right? I mean, that's what the Georgia Guidestones kind of are in the final analysis, is that they are a work of art, right? And that's the whole piece of the work that brings you to it, is the fact that there's this mystery surrounding who built it. There are these strange precepts. It's mysterious, and people want – I mean, that's exactly the kind of thing people want to see when they're, you know, driving endless hours through rural Georgia and they need something interesting to pass, or there's something interesting is there, you know. And it's interesting because thousands and thousands of people visit the Guidestones each year, and that was something that the people in the county didn't realize up until very recently.
So how does the county see these stones? Are they cherishing them? Did they wish they were never there? Clearly there is some kind of maintenance factor there. Is the maintenance done by the council, or do you have suspicions that actually R.C. Christian was part of the the maintenance of his Guidestones, or
now that would be hilarious. No, I don't think it's that way at all. The property is owned by the county, and actually, this gets me back around to a question that I forgot to answer for you earlier, which was about the property. Right, the money to buy the property that the Georgia Guidestone sits on, which is about 1 acre of land on the side of Highway 77. In the very northern part of Elbert County, Georgia. The money came from R.C. Christian. He got the banker, Wyatt Martin, who kept his identity secret, to establish a trust. He used the trust to buy that land from a man named Mullinex, who runs a ranch out there. And so then the trust turned around and deeded the land to Elbert County, and probably gave them a little bit of money to get them started on the maintenance of the place. Now, the county will go out there, and if people vandalize it, they'll clean it up, or if they spray paint on it, they'll clean stuff off. They put cameras up to make sure nobody tries to haul them down in their anti-New World Order fervor, which is good, because I was really starting to worry about 2 or 3 years ago. The vandalism was getting so bad out there that I was really afraid somebody was going to knock them down. So, and then they, you know, they trim the bushes and cut the grass. They didn't used to do that. Back in the 80s, you could go and snap a picture of the Guidestones, and there was nothing to separate it from the cow pasture that surrounds it. So the cows would be up there scratching their butts against the granite of this beautiful monument. And actually, it's weird because, you know, the conspiracy vandals have done more damage than all those cows could do over those years. It's kind of funny that how it works out that way. So,
like the good old days of Stonehenge, I would say. I mean, here we are. We are probably talking about a man, maybe with some connections, and we'll get into that in a second. As you're pointing out, if this was Ted Turner, if this was Donald Trump, this would be seen and discussed as, if it was a case of Donald Trump, maybe further signs of his madness and his vision as to how he sees the world. But it would be very specific. That wouldn't be this mystery. It would be completely a different kind of discussion which we would be having today.
And they'd be a different monument. They would be slightly larger and slightly more complete than they are.
And yet what we have here is something which, you know, the subtitle of your book is America's Most Mysterious Monument, and to some extent it is, and it definitely has become the subject of wild conspiracy theories.
Oh, absolutely. And it was really those conspiracy theories that first drew me to the monument. You know, I first encountered the Georgia Guidestones in 2004 when I was creating a radio series for my local college radio station about conspiracy theories and the occult and just different strange topics. It was called Out There. If you're interested, you can download it from the iTunes podcast directory. Just search for Out There. It didn't take very long. We'd done about 7 or 8 episodes, and we realized, oh, wait, there's this conspiracy story like right over 2 counties over, the Georgia Guidestones. So we would go out there and we start researching it. And, you know, I immediately started theorizing myself. I saw this guy's name, R.C. Christian, and I thought, oh, maybe that has something to do with the Rosicrucians, the Order of the Rosy Cross, which were this sort of like a cult group from the 17th century in Germany and France and other places. And so, you know, I researched a little bit of that, and we talk about some of that in the book. And that's a theory that is embraced by a lot of different people. Some of them don't like the monument, some of them do like the monument. So the Rosicrucian theory seems to be one that can break both ways, depending on what you think Rosicrucians are or how scared you are of occultists and your local neo-pagans or whatever, you know. It's sort of going to depend on that. But then you have other theories that are exclusively used by detractors of the monument. And these are people like Mark Dice and Alex Jones, for example, who they believe the monument is a call for genocide. That, yes, R.C. Christian was a member of the Rosicrucian Secret Society, and the Rosicrucian Secret Society is some evil group that's like the Illuminati, and they control the world and all this stuff. I mean, you know the basic tale, you know, and I'm not going to sit here and discuss whether it's true or not. This is just what many people believe. So, anyway, they have these beliefs about an Orwellian New World Order, right? They think that in the future the government is going to lock us up and put us all in the FEMA death camps, and there's going to be, you know, the more false flag terrorist attacks, because most of them believe in 9/11 conspiracies and stuff like this. It's a kind of a subset of people, for good or for ill, right? And I'd studied them for a long time, and it wasn't until I saw how they reacted to the Georgia Guidestones that I kind of, in many ways, took a step back, because, you know, a few years after our initial radio show, you know, I hadn't thought about the Guidestones in a while, and then I start hearing all these wild stories about people going out there trying to knock them down, spray painting all this stuff on them. And so that kind of got me back into the research on it. This was in 2008. It was right after the Obama election. And lo and behold, here's all this, one day there's all this graffiti painted all over the Georgia Guidestones and a giant bucket of epoxy thrown up onto the English face of them, which I mean, has just stained it permanently. You can't really get that stuff out of the pores of the granite. And I was just shocked because, like, I had been following conspiracy theories for a long time, and, like, I immediately knew, like, oh, wait, these are quotes directly from the Alex Jones film Endgame. Like, they were direct quotes from the film, like, spray-painted up on the guidestones. And I thought, oh, Lord, you know, like, my fellow conspiracy researchers have run amok here. What, you know? And that's, for me, as interesting a part of the story as the R.C. Christian mystery, is sort of this survey we do in one chapter of different people and how they link the Georgia Guidestones to their pre-existing conspiratorial beliefs, you know. Another one is Van Smith, who's written quite a bit on his website about the Georgia Guidestones and done some fairly thorough reporting on it, I felt. But some of it just strays into full-on numerology, and he somehow links the Georgia Guidestones to the Burj Khalif in Dubai, that super tall building that was built in Dubai yesterday. And it's just like the connections are just so random that, like, I can't make any, like, there's no sense to be made of it in a lot of cases. And like, these are just a couple of examples, right? You know, we've had guys go out there and record rants for YouTube and wearing masks, you know, right after they were vandalized, you know. We're here at your Stargate, the new, you know, the Georgia Guidestones, whatever. I mean, just really, just a lot of fantastic stuff goes on around there. And, like, it sort of has become this, like, my friend Austin calls it a prism of meaning, right? It sort of reflects back at you whatever kind of delusions you bring up the highway with you. You know, it's like the Empire Strikes Back, right? Luke says, you know, what's in there? I feel cold. Points at the cave. Looks over at Yoda. Yoda says, only what you take with you. And that's, in many ways, the Georgia Guidestones.
Well, it reminds me of Roslyn Chapel a few years ago when it became famous, but not yet as famous as it became because of the Da Vinci Code. And everybody had theories, and for some reason the answer to their theories was always Roslyn Chapel because it was ill-defined, and so people could get away with this. And the fact that there is mystery surrounding the Georgia Guidestones, that there is nothing really known about it, allows for an awful lot of leeway for people to use them for their pet theories, and that definitely seems to be happening. And I mean, on balance, would you say that the Guidestones are treated with respect by those who have heard about it? Is it just something which is gimmicky, or is it something which pretty much is made into something which it absolutely isn't?
I think all of those things, all at once. You know,
but definitely. What's the majority viewpoint at this moment in time? Do you think?
Okay, it depends on who you're asking. The majority viewpoint of the local community is one of some pride in that they have some tourist attraction in their town, something they're famous for, you know, and also one of sort of apathy, and often one of being sick of talking to amateur researchers, which, you know, kind of made it tough for me at times to write the book because I'd be, I had a full-on contract with a fairly major publisher, and sometimes I would call people and ask them for an interview about the Guidestones, and they'd already been asked like 50 stinking times by people who never even wrote up the interview or published it or did anything with it, just, you know, wanted to go out and play Scooby-Doo for a day or whatever, you know, with the Mystery Machine. Or what have you. You know, there's that reaction. There's the reaction of the conspiracy theorists, which they, just like with everything else, they all want to speak with one voice. And that voice says, you know, tear them down. They are evil. They call for genocide. They are the Ten Commandments of the New World Order. which is funny because these are a bunch of people who, by and large, are quote-unquote patriots. They are patriotic people. They believe in the U.S. Constitution. And they can't for the life of them see that they're limiting someone else's freedom of speech, freedom of expression, and freedom to make art by calling for the Guidestones to be torn down, you know. And, you know, it's strange because if, you know, and I'll give you a little, I won't tell the whole story, but I'll tease you a little bit here. You know, at the end of the book, we come around to this other tale from Elberton, and it's the tale of the very first granite monument that was ever built in the town near, over 100 years ago, and what happened to it, and what ignorance and hatred caused, basically. Anyway, so, you know, there's a lot of different reactions, and I guess for me, my personal reaction is, yes, I do have a lot of respect for the monument, and I try, whenever I talk about them in interviews, you know, I'm not here to promote population control or necessarily too many of these different 10 tenets that we're reading about, but I am here to promote the right of this guy to put a fabulous work of art up in the rural part of East Georgia. You know, I mean, I think that's really interesting because what is a good work of art? A good work of art causes discussion and it stirs controversy, like Stravinsky's Rite of Spring or something like that. You know, that caused riots and that was just classical music. Well, you know, the Georgia Guidestones have maybe caused a little bit of panic of their own, but, you know, that has much more to do with the viewer of the piece than it does with the piece itself. All it says about the piece is that the piece is really good to cause that kind of reaction.
Absolutely. And as a piece of art, they are truly, you know, beautiful to behold. They definitely have this artistic manner of behaving themselves. So here we are. We are suspecting a retired businessman with a bit of travel. But at the other point is somebody who clearly has a concept of art, who has identified languages which he wants to use, some of them which are ancient. He has incorporated astronomical alignments. Two aspects here. Do we think everything was done by one man? Did he have help? Was it impossible for one man to do these things on a practical level? I'm just thinking here about weights. Of you know, one stone on top of another, how high can you go, and all of these things for soil, and was there a soil analysis before they were placed there?
He certainly didn't build them himself. He designed them. Like he said, they need to be about yay tall, about yay wide. They need to have this printed on them, and he probably drew up a little model or built himself a little model. And I think you can still see that model at the Elbert Granite Museum, if I'm not mistaken. So, no, it was a thing where he had the plan, he gave them the plan and the money, and he stepped back for the sake of anonymity and only visited the town once or twice, maybe three times, after that first day, with the story I told you earlier, where he met the banker and the guy at the Elbert Granite Finishing Company dismissed him, thinking it was a prank. He only came two or three times after that, and it was the people around in the community that helped put it together. So it would be Joe Findlay at the Elbert Granite Finishing Company, and he later became the mayor of the town, interestingly enough. He helped put it together, and then they hired out people from the University of Georgia and a number of other institutions to do some of the other translations, and had to hire out certain special kind of surveyors and astronomers to get the alignments right. And strangely enough, I would say that, you know, it's very good, but it's eerie that some of these ancient sites that I've been to that, you know, track the equinox or have stones placed just in the right spot, like they tend to have a bigger degree of perfection than the Georgia Guidestones that were laid in 1980 with modern equipment and computers and stuff and college professors. So it's telling of how hard it is to mimic the work of the builders of Stonehenge or the other megaliths of ancient times.
Absolutely. I was out a few weeks ago with Duncan Lunan, who is actually one of the few people in the world who has built a modern megalithic site in Glasgow. And he's actually pointed out to me that his stone circle, which he erected in the 1970s, has got great inaccuracies because of the fact that it was done using technology rather than observations. And that's specifically what these computer models and everything else which academics are using don't tell you is refraction, how really the sun's image changes so much and is vastly different at sunrise and sunset than any computer can predict, and how this really affects the fact that, you know, these alignments, as mathematically accurate they might seem to be on the computer, in reality it's far harder to pull off. And I mean, the Georgia Guidestones to me, I mean, it's a symbol of American conspiracy writing on two levels. One, because they are used by many as kind of like cementing some of the theories or evidence for some of the theories. But also at the other level, in the sense that there is this wider range of thinking, which to me is sometimes all over the place. Which really puts these things out there, and what we have here is something which, you know, clearly was not somebody trying to build an anecdote or whatever you want to an antithesis to the UN building in New York. This is not some grandiose scheme which costs millions of dollars to make and you know, decades to plot. This is pretty much one man's statement in a small quiet corner of America. So where does this leave you? And you've been observing in various capacities the American conspiracy scene. Where are you in your thinking on that scene?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? I think that I'm watching the American conspiracy scene drift ever further to the right and ever further into a milieu of delusion and irrationality. If I look at the conspiracy theories that I was researching for the broadcasts and radio programs that I've created over the past 5-10 years and compare them in their ludicrousness to the conspiracy theories that I'm seeing now coming out, there's no even comparison. Like, and it's things like, and it's also the fact that it's all like all of these folks seem to be very connected to one particular political candidate who is good in some ways and I have huge disagreements with in other ways. And I don't like seeing every conspiracy theorist in the country get co-opted by the Republican Party. It kind of annoys me. So,
well, I mean, the Republican Party definitely has made conspiracy theories go mainstream, and specifically the aforementioned presidential candidate and head of the American Apprentice definitely, you know, used conspiracy theories in trying to get a point across, and then was easily shut down publicly when he really went public with his conspiracy theories, claiming that Obama you know was a Kenyan citizen. Why is the conspiracy scene drifting towards the right? And this might be a related question or a separate question, and becoming more absurd.
Well, the reason why it's drifting towards the right, one reason is because we have the political party on the left has more power right now. So, and you've always got a scapegoat, whoever's in power. They're always the ones doing all the nefarious conspiracy theories because they're in power. So 5 or 6 years ago, everyone was hating on Bush and Cheney, right? And there seemed to be some mix of sort of like left-wing progressive activists with traditional libertarian, more right-wing kind of people, and they would mix together at these conspiracy events that I would attend and cover for my radio show. Now it's just not that way. Like, if I couldn't be part of a conspiracy research group and say, oh yeah, I'm going to go vote for Barack Obama in November, which I am, because I mean, they would just be like, oh, you're voting for the Antichrist, basically, and they because they've got their guy. And it's not just my political disagreements with them that I find disconcerting. What I find most disconcerting is the cult-like behavior of many of these conspiracy groups and their behavior in online environments. A couple of examples. One is that there's this idea of fair game. Right. If you look at something like the Church of Scientology or the Mormon Church, like if you attack them and like you make a documentary about them or something that kind of attacks their practices, you're quote unquote fair game to them after that. And so the Scientologists will sue you and they'll do everything they can. They'll defame you in the press. They'll do everything they can to screw with you just as bad as you've screwed with them. Well, the conspiracy theorists, many of them in the country are the very same way. They have a concept of fair game, which is, if you're a member of the alternative press and the alternative media and you give their views their day in court and you agree with them for a while and you decide at some point later that you don't agree with them anymore, like on something like, say, bombs in the World Trade Center, like if you switch up your view on any of those things that you have the right to make your own decision about, you're going to get attacked. And we need to look at this guy, Charlie Veach. Okay, this was the big conspiracy story of the past year as far as I was concerned. This guy was like, I think he still runs a blog called The Love Police. Okay, and they would be sort of like a mainstay at a lot of these political protests, these conspiracy events. He would cover this stuff much like I used to with my old shows. And he got cast on a BBC documentary called 9/11 Conspiracy Road Trip. Did you happen to see this, Philip?
I did not.
Okay, it may have been on Channel 4, actually. It may not have been BBC. But anyway, so the whole point behind this documentary was like the producer didn't believe in 9/11 conspiracy theories. And so he wanted to find some local conspiracy theorists and take them to New York and kind of like show them on the ground kind of what happened on 9/11 and talk to some of the experts, talk to some of the people that were there. I guess his idea was he hoped to change their minds. Well, he had some success with this in the show, and the guy that changed his mind the most was Charlie Veach, who was also the most prominent member of the cast in the conspiracy community. And when Charlie Veach said on his blog that he didn't believe there were bombs in the World Trade Center anymore, that the plane probably did do enough damage and the fire probably did do enough damage to knock the buildings down, the level of heresy that he committed there was beyond the pale to these people. And that should show you where their mentality is. He got death threats. They hacked his website, called him a pedophile, assaulted him. He had to have a couple of people arrested. Like, this went on for a month. This is still going on. You know, you just look this guy up, Charlie Veach, and just look at the way people talk about him, the way people run him down. And all he did was say, I don't believe there are bombs in the World Trade Center. I'm still in with you guys. I'm still a conspiracy researcher. I just don't agree with you on this one John 3:16 belief that you have over here, which is basically the way they treat a lot of different things. And, you know, I had enough time in the church as a young kid being told I had to believe this, this, and this, and that if I didn't, that I wasn't worth a shit. And I don't need that from conspiracy researchers. I got into all this to have fun. I got into all this to go on an intellectual adventure. I'm not on someone's crusade here. I'm not trying to start the Ron Paul revolution. And I guess in the final analysis, that's what I'm getting down to. It's like, it's just not fun anymore. Like, everybody's just taking themselves and what they're saying way too seriously, and they can't see that the more they do that, the less defense they have against delusion. So,
but, I mean, the one trend I have been seeing in the last few years, specifically in America, is that the conspiracy theories are actually, you know, becoming more ludicrous. A recent one I read a few days ago was about how somebody is absolutely sure that he saw Obama on Mars in the 1980s. You know, identifying Obama with the Antichrist is another one. Conspiracy theories used to be about quite mundane things, whereby people did certain things and the government lied about them, and afterwards they were found out, you know, to be lying about them. Why all of a sudden has, you know, conspiracy theories made this jump into hyperspace, whereby all logic is left behind? And why do people believe that it is a credible story that Obama was on Mars in the 1980s?
Okay. Well, maybe we won't use Obama on Mars in the 1980s as our example, but there are plenty of other... We'll use chemtrails as our example. Okay, you're familiar with the idea of chemtrails?
Absolutely.
So, okay, so I won't explain it to your audience. You can just Google it, guys, if you don't know what I'm talking about. Millions, or at least hundreds of thousands of conspiracy theorists across the United States believe in the idea of chemtrails, believe that when they look up in the sky and they see a plane fly over and the exhaust and the water vapor kicking off of those engines on that plane creates a cloud through water vapor, through a very known meteorological process, they believe that that, by and large, is a government plot and that someone is spraying aluminum particulates out behind the plane. Okay, this is just what they believe. They can't conceive of the fact that air traffic has grown by like 100 times over the past 50 years, that there are millions and millions of flights going on every day all over this world. They can't wrap their heads around it. And here's how you convince someone of something like this. You play to their sense of hero worship. You find someone that they've already learned to accept the preachings of, and you have them present the idea because they are speaking from a position of authority. That's Alex Jones to a T. There's a certain large percentage of his viewership that anything comes out of his mouth, they're probably going to take as gospel, just like Bill O'Reilly or Rush Limbaugh's followers do. It's no different. You got that. But what people like Alex Jones and some of these hardcore conspiracy sites have that have mastered, really, that the political parties in the United States haven't, is the idea of the narrative, of building this internally consistent narrative of history, of the present, and of the future. And never ever deviating from that narrative. If a piece of news comes in that contradicts what you've already said, you've got to twist it to fit that narrative. The best example I can give is that if you look at the site InfoWars, every single time there is a terrorist attack of any size, shape, or origin anywhere in the world, they immediately publish a story calling it a false flag terror attack, because that's their internally consistent narrative of history. It's one of false flag terror attacks. So you don't wait to do the research. You just assume that the world works like you've said it works. You just assume that every terrorist attack is a false flag terrorist attack. You just assume that every bill one political party or the other passes is some evil conspiracy to take away your guns and kill grandma or whatever. And it's this narrative, and it's not just that it's an internally consistent narrative, it's that it is a large and complex story. If we get into the conspiracy mindset and into the conspiracy community, what we find is a very wide story with a huge number of data points. It's not like reading a novel, it's like watching Star Trek for 7 seasons. Okay, it's not like reading a comic book. It's like reading everything Tolkien wrote about Middle Earth and filing it all back in your brain. And then so you can completely make sense of any new piece of data that comes in through the story, because you have this giant database in your mind already. And so in the final analysis, like, you know, Zbigniew Brzezinski and Operation Northwoods and 9/11 terror attacks and chemtrails and crack the CIA and all of that is no different than orcs and dwarves and hobbits and, Minas Tirith and Gandalf. Like, it's just proper names that build a huge database that you can go and sift through in your mind when you're bored. And it's, this is kind of an idea that I've been working on over the past month and thinking about a lot, but I don't know if it makes any sense to you, but there you have it.
Well, thank you for providing insight into your mind and specifically into Georgia Guidestones and how they feature on America's, I would say, Book of Secrets. They are America's most mysterious monument. It is the subtitle of your book. The title is The Georgia Guidestones. It's been recently published by the Disinformation Press. Your name is Raymond Wiley. Where can people find this book apart from in bookshops?
You can find it on Amazon or at guidestones.us. We're selling directly from our website a PDF ebook and an MP3 audiobook version of the work. And the PDF ebook is $4.99. The audiobook is $7.99, which is like a third the price of Amazon. So go get it, y'all.
Raymond, it's been great to have you on our show. If our listeners want to hear you again, they can do so in a number of ways. There is the spiritrevolution.com website. There is bbsradio.com. There is also iTunes. For all of those three, you can get this interview as well as several other. In fact, on iTunes, a year and a half's worth of interviews are waiting to be discovered there. This was, however, our episode of The Spirit Revolution for this week. We will be back next week with another one. But until then, from myself and Kathleen in absentia, the truth against the world. And that's this.
Brilliant.
Time flew.
It really did. I hope I didn't go over, and I hope I didn't ramble too much at the end. I'm probably going to write that up into a paper. And I've just been trying to enunciate it on these interviews, and I get really wordy sometimes, so.
No problem. So this is set for May 15th, I think, yes?
Okay.
And I will, you can assume it's going to go out on May 15th, but I will, can I do that on May 15th? Yes, I will send you an email just before confirming, and then as soon as possible afterwards, which might be a few days, because on the 15th we're in the middle of nowhere, I will send you a link to the archived interview.
Great, Philip. It's been a pleasure, man. Really has.
It's been a pleasure to have you on, and if there is anything else which you do in the future, please keep us in mind. We would be glad to have you back on.
Thank you very much, and just send me a link when it's up. I'll make sure to post it around.
Thank you very much, and have a great rest of the day and a great weekend.
Too. Night.
Cheers. Bye-bye.